This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, extremism on the rise in Pakistan. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. A gun and bomb attack on a university in northwestern Pakistan last week killed at least 20 people and wounded dozens. Khalifa Umar Mansur, the leader of a breakaway faction of the Taliban, claimed responsibility for the deadly attack at Bacha Khan University in the town of Charsada. The spokesman for the so-called official Pakistani Taliban, Tehrik-e-Taliban, Mohammed Khorasani, said that his group had nothing to do with the university assault. Pakistan alleges that leaders and commanders of the anti-state Taliban militants have taken refuge on the Afghan side of the border after fleeing army-led counterinsurgency operations. But Afghan Interior Ministry spokesperson Sadiq Siddiqui dismisses allegations that there are terrorist bases in Afghanistan being used against Pakistan. Well, after a year in which the Pakistani Taliban had finally seemed to be pushed to the margins with attacks at their lowest pace in a decade, the university assault renewed worries that the insurgency has survived and retained its capacity for brutality. Well, with us to discuss rising extremism in Pakistan, as well as a resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan, are two distinguished regional analysts who are no strangers at these VOA microphones. Lisa Curtis is a senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank based here in Washington, and Michael Kugelman. He's senior program associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a policy group also based here in Washington. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Lisa Curtis from the Heritage Foundation, let me begin with you. What, in your view, is the significance of this horrific attack? What does it say about Pakistan's purported efforts to fight extremism?
Well, I think it does show that the TTP is still able to strike Pakistani targets, despite the fact that the Pakistan military has been engaged in military operations against their bases in the tribal border areas. In fact, it's been at this for the last 18 months.
TTP, of course, is the acronym for the
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan,
exactly.
Or Pakistani Taliban.
All right.
So I think it does show that they're still able to attack targets in Pakistan, unfortunately. But this is despite the fact that we actually saw some reduction in terrorism in Pakistan in 2015. Some people are saying attacks were down by as much as 50%. So, you know, I think things are trending in the right direction, but as this attack shows, terrorism is still a major problem in Pakistan, and it's going to take a lot of effort and a long time to really uproot the problem. And this attack is also significant in that the Pakistani government has claimed it was conducted from bases in Afghanistan. And what we have seen is, as Pakistan has cracked down on the TTP in their bases in the tribal areas in Pakistan, they have fled to Afghanistan. And so now the key is for the Afghan government to make sure that they go after the new bases that the TTP is setting up in Afghanistan. Because we know that the director of the attacks, Umar Mansur, who is with a faction of the TTP, was directing the attackers via cell phone from his base in Afghanistan. So it's going to take a cooperative effort between Pakistan and Afghanistan to make sure that the perpetrators of the attacks receive justice.
Well, turning to you, Michael Kugelman, for your reaction, and also what do you make of the fact that this so-called breakaway faction has taken credit, not the so-called official, the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, and also the Afghan official position that is rejecting the Pakistani allegations that these terrorist attacks were conducted from Afghanistan? I mean, what do we make of all these sort of contradictory explanations and reactions?
Getting to the attack itself, I think what's very significant is that a school was attacked. So obviously, this is not the first time a school has been attacked on this level of Pakistan. And back in December 2014, we all recall the army-run school in Peshawar getting attacked, where you had about 150 people killed, most of them children. It's very significant that the Taliban is specifically going after centers of education, because the Taliban understands that education can, at least in part, start to combat the hardline ideologies that drive militancy and terrorism. And the fact of the matter is, there have been continued threats being issued by Taliban spokespersons saying that schools will be targeted again all over the country. And it's caused all kinds of fear and concern in Pakistan. In recent days, a number of schools have been closed down. In Punjab, which is the largest, most prosperous province of Pakistan, the government has said that it's cold weather that caused the schools to be closed. But I think that security concerns had something to do with it. Now, getting to the issue of blame and the fact that you had different factions of the Taliban essentially rejecting what others had said, I think the bottom line here is that we don't really know what's going on for sure. But what we do know is that this Pakistani military offensive in North Waziristan, which was launched in June of 2014, it certainly was able to kill off a lot of Pakistani Taliban fighters and their allies. But many other Pakistani Taliban fighters simply moved into other tribal areas inside Pakistan. A number of them, I think, did go into Afghanistan, but not all of them. So certainly I think that there are Pakistani Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. I wouldn't necessarily say that they've established sanctuaries or safe havens on the level that you've had in Pakistan in the tribal areas over the years. But basically you have militants all over. You have them in tribal areas of Pakistan. You have them on the Afghanistan side. No one really knows for sure where the terrorists that launched this particular attack were located. But the bottom line is that they are still there and they're still poised to attack.
Turning back to you, Lisa Curtis, I'd like to refer to an article that Michael Kugelman wrote for CNN entitled Why Extremism Still Haunts Pakistan. And piggyback off what he said in his response, which was that, okay, you have the Pakistan killing off many fighters since this North Waziristan offensive in June of 2014. But as he said in the article, you can't, kill necessarily an ideology this way. How do you explain the persistent extremism emanating from Pakistan, no matter how vigorous the country's attempts are to extinguish it through these kinds of offensives?
I think there are many reasons why we still have this virulent terrorist threat emanating from Pakistan. But I think one is certainly some of the policies that we have seen the military establishment pursue. These dual policies of fighting some terrorists like Al-Qaeda and the TTP, yet on the other hand, supporting, tacit or otherwise, groups that attack in Afghanistan or India. And these are groups like the Haqqani Network, as is the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which conducted the 2008 Mumbai attacks in India, and the Jaish-e-Mohammed, which the Indians claim is responsible for the attack on the Indian airbase on January 2nd, which has fueled tensions between India and Pakistan. So I think that part of the reason that Pakistan is having such difficulty in tackling this problem is because of this flawed policy of trying to support some terrorists while fighting others. And I don't think you can attack the ideology unless you're doing it in a more holistic way. And it's a big problem not only for Pakistan, but obviously for U.S. national security interests as well. Even though groups like LET and Jaish-e-Mohammed are focused regionally, they have killed U.S. citizens. The LET, in the case of the Mumbai attacks, 6 U.S. citizens were killed in those attacks. And of course, the Haqqani Network has been responsible for the deaths of American soldiers in Afghanistan. So I would argue that until Pakistan takes a more holistic approach and really seeks to uproot and confront this Islamist extremist ideology, which is driving all of these groups, they simply won't be successful in overcoming the terrorist challenges.
Turning to you, Michael Kugelman, to talk about what's at the root of this persistent extremism. Do you agree with Lisa that these flawed policies are in part responsible, this lack of coherency, attacking some groups as opposed to others, like Haqqani Network and others that are focused on India, which Pakistan still sees as an adversary?
Yeah, I agree with Lisa 100%. I mean, when you apply such a selective policy to militants, when you go after some militants but not others just because of who they happen to be targeting, they're all cut from the same ideological cloth. So it's a very dangerous policy. I mean, getting back to the ideology, what you have is a case of hardline rhetoric having become entrenched across society in Pakistan. You have private TV channels, which are extremely popular and have these talk show hosts who are essentially celebrities. They spew very hardline rhetoric, which essentially blames all of Pakistan's problems on the Indians or the Americans. And there's this constant focus on Islam being under threat, that Pakistan is not responsible for any of these things happening. It has to be coming from other places, other sources. You hear this on the TV media. You hear this in the comments of clerics who are also very influential in Pakistan. This appears in school textbooks. And the security establishment itself and the government itself oftentimes propagates such stuff. What was notable is right after the Charsada attack, you had top officials in Pakistan suggesting that India was in some way behind this attack. So the consequence here is that there's been no counter-narrative. The government has made no effort to develop any type of alternate narrative to contest, to combat these hardline ideologies that are emanating from all aspects of society. And the reason for this goes to what Lisa was saying before, that you have the state having used this policy for a very long time of essentially looking the other way, at the very least, when it comes to some militant groups, and in other cases, actually providing support, close support. So you're not going to be able to do much about hardline extremist ideologies if you continue to use those types of policies.
Yeah, I think the challenge is you can't turn off these ideologies. You can't turn them on and off at will. And once they're out there, you're going to see them proliferate. And I think the ambivalence that we've seen from the Pakistani government to these different terrorist groups, supporting some, not supporting mm-hmm. others, has created confusion in the mind of the Pakistani public. And I wanted to make another point. You've got the terrorism problem, which, of course, stems from these hardline extremist ideologies. But you also have a broader problem, which was represented just this week in protests in Lahore, where they were protesting the death penalty for the assassin of Salman Taseer. Salman Taseer was the governor of Punjab who was gunned down by his own bodyguard in 2011 because of his support to a Christian woman who was facing unfounded blasphemy charges. So he was standing up for religious minorities and trying to roll back the blasphemy legislation, which is often used against Pakistan's religious minorities, not to mention other Muslims. So I think the fact that you still see segments of the population who would support the assassination of a senior government official because he is trying to stand up for the rights of religious minorities, that just shows how deep the radicalization has gone into Pakistani society.
Well, Michael Kugelman, I was going to ask you, do you see any segments of society that are actually standing up against this type of extremism? It doesn't sound very likely given what Lisa's saying, but are there segments in society that are railing against these incoherent, contradictory policies as well as this extremism and intolerance?
The so-called liberal sphere in Pakistan has certainly been shrinking increasingly over the years. You know, unfortunately, one of the major repositories for this advocacy or for these efforts against radicalization and hardline ideologies happens to be social media, but that's not going to get you very far. There have been some encouraging signs over the last year, in my view, and particularly since the Peshawar school attack. There's been a civil society campaign led by a very impressive young lawyer named Gibran Nasser. I imagine he's probably in his 20s. He's a very young guy. He decided after the Peshawar school attack, a hardline cleric in Islamabad essentially refused to condemn the attacks, and he basically endorsed them. So then Gibran Nasser launched a campaign out in the open, very dangerous thing to do in Pakistan, where he called on the state to arrest this guy. His name is Abdulaziz. He had, at the high water mark of this protest, several dozens, even several hundred people out in the street. Unfortunately, it's largely petered out at this point, and unfortunately, Nasser also became the target of a lot of criticism and abuse accusations, saying that he was a Hindu, all these outrageous things, just because of these views that he was taking. So certainly, you know, civil society has been leading some efforts to take on these types of ideologies, but it's very difficult in Pakistan. There's a lot of concern, a lot of fear. You rarely have people coming out in the streets. There are human rights activists that have been trying to target the blasphemy laws, but really ever since Salman Taseer was killed, you see much less of that, at least on public levels. And this is really very worrisome.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Lisa Curtis, she's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Kugelman, he's Senior Program Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, also here in Washington. And we're discussing the rise of extremism in Pakistan in the wake of the terror attack at Bacha Khan University. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to John Batista Ngatia, who listens on shortwave radio from Karatina, Kenya. And Karatina, by the way, hosts the largest open-air market in East Africa and the second largest in Africa. Thanks for your email feedback, John. Well, back to you, Lisa Curtis, in the few minutes we have left. What about on the Afghan side? How much does Afghanistan bear any responsibility for what's going on in Pakistan? We know that the situation there is still unstable. Taliban is also resurgent. What do you have to say about the Afghan side of the equation?
Well, I think the Afghan government has its hands full with the Taliban threat to the country. The Taliban have been putting pressure on the Afghan security forces. The Taliban were able to briefly capture the northern Afghan city of Kunduz last September. They have been making gains in Helmand province. The U.S. has been supporting the Afghan security forces. So I think that they will be able to hold on to key areas, but the Taliban are certainly giving the Afghan security forces a run for their money. So they are focused on the threat from the Taliban. And despite the fact that the violence is increasing in Afghanistan, what we see is the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, is still trying to reach out to Pakistan, a lot different than his predecessor, Hamid Karzai. He is working with Pakistan as well as the U.S. and China. They call it the Quad countries, who are trying to put a dialogue process in play with the Taliban. Of course, you had the first ever face-to-face talks between Taliban leaders and the Afghan government in Pakistan last July. Unfortunately, those talks broke down when news came out that Mullah Omar, the supreme leader of the Taliban, had died over 2 years ago. That caused some splintering in the Taliban and breakdown in the talks. But there are still efforts to get those talks back on track. And I think that, you know, President Ghani should receive credit for being willing to continue this talks process with Pakistan, despite the fact that Taliban attacks are increasing. And the fact that the Quad is meeting February 6th for this purpose, to try to lay out the groundwork for a dialogue process, is very encouraging.
Michael Kugelman, how do you characterize the relationship between the Afghan government and Pakistan?
Well, the Afghanistan-Pakistan relationship is one that's invested with tremendous amounts of mistrust and hostility, and driven in great part because of the Afghan perception that you've essentially have had Pakistani intelligence, or more broadly Pakistani security establishment, complicity in some of these terror attacks in Afghanistan over the years. But I agree with Lisa that there's reason to be somewhat optimistic, at least at this point, about prospects for some sort of reconciliation process. The fact that President Ghani is willing to work with the Pakistanis is a huge step forward from the previous administration, President Karzai, as Lisa had said. But President Ghani is taking a huge risk in doing this, because much of the political class and all the vested interests in Afghanistan, they don't want to be working with the Pakistanis. And you need to work with the Pakistanis if you want to get the Taliban to the peace table, because Pakistan has influence over the Taliban, and particularly the main branch of the Afghan Taliban that would be coming to the peace table, led by Mullah Mansoor, the new supreme leader of the Taliban. But I think the problem here is that it's not clear to anyone if the Afghan Taliban is really invested in any a reconciliation process. The Taliban, as was said before, has been doing so well on the battlefield of late. It's been scoring some pretty impressive victories. What incentive would it have to step off the battlefield and start talking? I think that the Taliban would have a lot of leverage at the negotiating table, and it could make big demands, such as having some sort of role in some sort of governing administration in Afghanistan. And I don't imagine that the Afghan government would be willing to go there. But the bottom line is that you need a political solution to end the fighting and the terror and the violence in Afghanistan. There's no way around that. All this talk about foreign troop presence in Afghanistan, all this talk about the U.S. altering its troop withdrawal plan. You know, when we had 120,000 foreign combat troops in Afghanistan, the violence didn't end there. So you really need this reconciliation process to go forward. But I really don't know if in the end it can happen. I certainly think that it could start, but whether it could lead to a successful outcome, I don't really know about that.
Well, Lisa Curtis, how do you see any incentives for the Afghan Taliban to come to the table, given they're making so many gains on the ground? Do you see that they still would like to participate in a political process or continue gaining on the battlefield?
Well, I think a lot of this does hinge on Pakistan and the position that the Pakistan military takes. They are in a position to put pressure on the Taliban if they so choose. So I think a lot of this hinges on what they will do. I think Michael's right. The Taliban have been making military gains, but I don't think they will be able to capture cities for long periods of time, because the U.S. has shown, the U.S. and NATO, that they will support the Afghan security forces. They will provide that air support when necessary, which they have done both in Kunduz, in Helmand, to help fend off the Taliban. But another factor that I think would motivate the Taliban to consider participating in talks is the fact that they are starting to splinter. There are factions that don't approve of Mullah Mansour and his leadership. They're very suspicious of the way he kept the information about Mullah Omar's death secret. They blame him for being too close to Pakistani intelligence. And ISIS elements have been able to capitalize on this fracturing within the Taliban. So you could make an argument for perhaps why the time is ripe for them to start to negotiate with the Afghan government before they start fracturing to the point of really it hurting their ability to make gains.
All right. Well, for the last word, Michael Kugelman, any thoughts on how you think a deal could be struck with the Taliban, and what impact would that have on stability, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan?
Well, I think that any deal would need to involve the Taliban's guarantee that they would renounce violence, that they would respect the Afghan constitution, particularly if they were to be brought into the government in some way. But again, even that seems rather remote to me. And as Lisa said, it's a long time before we get to a point where we're even talking seriously about this type of outcome. And, you know, I should add here that there is a risk that, as we've discussed, the Taliban is fracturing. You have all of these spin-off groups that have rejected the new leader, Mullah Mansour. Not all Taliban factions agree to the idea of peace. I mean, certainly Mullah Mansour, the supreme leader, seems to agree with the idea, in theory, of sitting down to discuss a reconciliation process. There are plenty of Taliban factions that would keep fighting, even if a reconciliation process were to start. And there are plenty of Taliban factions that would keep fighting even if there were to be a deal. And this does not bode well for stability in Afghanistan or, by extension, in Pakistan. And also, there is the ISIS fear. I think it's an important point to make that the Taliban has been splintering on so many levels, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. If you have the parent Afghan Taliban or the major Mullah Mansour-led faction pursuing a reconciliation process and much less concluding some sort of peace deal, you're going to have a number of Taliban fighters and Taliban commanders that will probably be willing to throw their allegiances over to ISIS. And, you know, according to estimates coming from the U.S. Intelligence Committee, there are already several hundred fighters in eastern Afghanistan who are basically thrown their allegiances to Islamic State. Now, that's not to say that you're going to have a huge Islamic State presence developing as you have in Iraq or Syria, but I think it's still something to be concerned about and could be one of the factors why President Obama decided to do away with his original troop withdrawal plan, in the sense that he was willing to keep troops in the country for longer than he intended. I think that he really is concerned not only about the ferocity of the Taliban insurgency, but also because of this developing ISIS profile in Afghanistan.
indeed a topic for the next program. I'm afraid for now that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests Lisa Curtis, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center here in Washington. Thanks to both of you, as always, for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.